friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 107 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And joining Michelle is... The Pimping Bell! The Pimping Bell exists to highlight especially noteworthy content, so pay attention when the Pimping Bell rings! Our mission here on Dermasphere is to bring you discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology, so that you can free up your day to take care of more patients and perform whatever activities you need to do to prevent burnout, etc. Couple reminders slash announcements before we get in. If you want to experience some more educational activity with us, you can join the University of Utah's Dermatology Echo series. That's one Friday out of each month. It's free. There's some CME. You can present some of your patients. We'll put a link in the show notes. And also, if you want to hang out with me in person, there are a couple meetings in Idaho in September. Practical Dermatology for Primary Care and the Intermountain Dermatology Society meetings. Again, we'll put some link in the notes. Also, some episodes or portions of Dermasphere are now available on a website called ViewMedi. If you're unfamiliar, it's V-U-M-E-D-I and is a resource, again, free for healthcare professionals to see videos to educate them about various things in their specialty. And we've got one of our members of Team Dermasphere, Lara Dela Cruz, thank you very much, has been adapting some of our content to put up there. So check it out, V-U-M-E-D-I. We'll try to put a link in the show notes as well. All right, getting into it. Michelle, I think you and I can both agree that I am a fun guy.
You are a fun guy.
I do not want any fun guy infecting my patients, especially this new resistant strain that I read about. So this is from a publication called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is from the CDC. And the authors include Avram Kaplan and Jeremy Gold. Shout out to Andy Pavia, infectious disease guru here at the University of Utah, who brought my attention to this article. So, Trichophyton indotiniae.
Indotiniae.
At least I think that's how you pronounce it. It's a dermatophyte that's an emerging infectious disease. It's resistant to terbinafine, and for a while it's been seen in Asia, Europe, and Canada, but we don't care about those places because they're not the United States.
Oh, goodness.
But now here it is in the U.S. So this particular publication is the first report of it appearing in the United States of America. I was kidding, by the way. We obviously care about those other countries. So this was two patients in New York City, one who had recent international travel to Bangladesh and the other who didn't have any international exposure, so that's even more concerning. And in addition to being resistant, these were fairly virulent because they were widespread, impressive plaques of tinea, original speciation, so Trichophyton mentagrophytes, or T. mentag to its friends. But after no improvement with terbinafine, they used fancy molecular techniques to show the organism to in fact be this Trichophyton indotiniae thing. One of these two patients cleared after 4 weeks of PO itraconazole. The other got 4 weeks of griziofulvin and got 80% better, according to the article. The authors point out that labs generally misidentify this new organism as either T. mentag or T. interdigitale. Correct identification requires genomic sequencing. So if you're suspicious of it, the authors say you should contact a state or local health department for specialized testing. There's also an email in the article. It's an amusing email, fungaloutbreaks@cdc.gov.
Oh my goodness.
They say that if you are a state or local health official and you want more information, you can email them. But perhaps if you just don't know where else to turn to try to get the special testing, you can try fungaloutbreaks@cdc.gov. Don't try fungaloutbreaks@gmail.com. I don't know who's monitoring that one. The authors say, consider T. indotiniae infection in patients with widespread tinea, particularly when eruptions do not improve with first-line topical antifungal agents or oral terbinafine. And they also are throwing a little shade here. They say the emergence and spread of tea and dottinier in South Asian countries has been linked to the inappropriate use of widely available topical combination creams containing antifungals, antibiotics, and high-potency corticosteroids. I remember when I was a resident, one of my co-residents took a trip to Mexico or something and came back with this tube of something called Quadraderm, which is like two antifungals plus betamethasone plus neomycin or something. And he was like, Luke, you're not a very good dermatologist. So here, just put this in everything you see and you'll be fine.
Oh my goodness.
So antibiotic stewardship is important, is really the takeaway here. And if you see, you know, widespread tinea, and especially if it's not getting better with piodrobinephine, consider Trichophyton indotiniae.
Fascinating. What an interesting, like, emerging pathogen for us to have to think about. I'm going to double down on my shower shoes when I'm traveling because we know that this monster is circulating now. So I think a bit of caution, as they say, is worth a pound of cure. And that cure can be even harder to obtain unless you have Quadraderm. Just kidding. Okay, so...
So what you're going to do then is wear, like, water socks plus Crocs. Is that the plan?
Exactly. It has to be bulletproof tinea prevention. I love this. I'm trying to make some kind of a connection to the next article, and I'm not... Oh, you know what? Actually, where you pick up a lot of tinea happens to be in the shower. And you know what else you can see in the shower if you're experiencing female pattern hair loss? Shed hairs, which makes everybody sad. So let's talk about new potential treatments for female pattern hair loss. So we have here a lovely article out of the Journal of Cosmetic Dermatology entitled Bicalutamide. There's an extra syllable in there. Bicalutamide and the new perspective for female pattern hair loss treatment, what dermatologists should know. The first author is Raquel de Melo Carvalho, and the corresponding author is Daniel Fernandez Melo, and they're out of Sao Paulo, Brazil. So, female pattern hair loss is the most common part of alopecia in women, and we know that it affects body image and self-esteem. The only FDA-approved medication currently for female pattern hair loss is topical minoxidil, and it has a variable response rate. Of course, there are other therapeutics that many of us use, including low-dose oral minoxidil, finasteride, dutasteride, and spironolactone. The authors here point out that bicalutamide may be an emergent selective androgen receptor antagonist that has favorable safety and tolerability profile and may be an attractive candidate for treating patients with female pattern hair loss. So in this review article, they're going to summarize and discuss the key information on this therapy for female pattern hair loss. As it has no diuretic effect and does not cross the blood-brain barrier, it may have a very nice side effect profile and be attractive for that reason. It also has little effect on serum luteinizing hormone, which some of the other therapeutics can implicate. Bicalutamide is also found to be effective on people who are presenting with other features of hyperandrogenism, including seborrhea, acne, and hirsutism, and had relatively mild and well-tolerated adverse effects. So all of these things may lend to it being a preferred therapeutic for female pattern hair loss. Of course, they urge, like any responsible author should, randomized clinical trials to establish ideal dosing of the drug, but it might be an effective and promising therapeutic. So what is the state of where we are right now? So we talked about topical minoxidil. Anti-androgen therapies have also been a mainstay of the disease, as androgen exposure to sensitive hair follicles is fundamental to the development of the condition. Anti-androgen therapies include 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, which include finasteride and dutasteride. And their job, of course, is to prevent testosterone from turning into bigger, better testosterone, which is dihydrotestosterone, and which is quite toxic to hair follicles. You also have steroidal anti-androgens, which are cyproterone acetate and spironolactone. So if you were to be asked the question, how are cyproterone acetate and spironolactone like each other, you could say, well, those are steroidal anti-androgens. And then our non-steroidal anti-androgens, which are flutamide and bicalutamide. So what makes something a steroid, Luke?
A bunch of steroid rings so that it can pass through the cell membrane.
Exactly. So steroids have this three ring. It's called a phenanthrene polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon. And there's basically three fused benzene rings. And then there's a fourth D ring added in these steroids. And Luke is exactly right. That helps them to be able to affect their changes on the cells. As we know, steroid hormones actually change gene expression in cells.
So residents, if you get some kind of question about receptors, if something's a steroid, the receptor is going to be intracellular because the molecule passes through the lipid membrane because it's lipophilic.
Exactly. And that's why it has that structure, so it can penetrate the lipid membrane. So the intracellular androgen receptor in the hair follicles are located in the dermal papillae, and both testosterone and dihydrotestosterone can link themselves to that receptor to promote changes in DNA transcription that leads to follicular miniaturization. So let's talk about what we had before. So cyproterone and flutamide, these were first-generation androgen receptor blockers. In a randomized uncontrolled trial that compared flutamide and cyproterone acetate, only the patients getting the flutamide got a therapeutic benefit in the study of patients with female pattern hair loss. Flutamide has shown efficacy in the treatment of female pattern hair loss, but it causes hepatotoxicity, which prevents it from being used significantly, and it also causes hot flashes, which is not necessarily something women who are having hair loss want to also have. So flutamide, well, seems attractive. I go, well, shove a flute right through my liver while I'm having a hot flash, why don't you, if you want to give me flutamide? So we don't use flutamide. Spironolactone is a potassium-sparing diuretic, as we all know. It competitively blocks the androgen receptor, and it also inhibits ovarian androgen production. It's used a lot for female pattern hair loss and hirsutism, as well as acne. I use it for a lot of my patients. The anti-androgen dose is 100 to 200 milligrams. Most common side effects are menstrual irregularities, postural hypotension, and electrolyte disturbances. Of course, the electrolyte disturbances can be dangerous, especially if spironolactone is paired with Bactrim or Cipro, which can also act as potassium-sparing diuretics. So you could end up with too much potassium in your blood, which is how we kill people with lethal injection. So let's not do that to hair loss patients. You can safely use spironolactone in a lot of patients, but women over 45 may have a higher incidence of electrolyte abnormalities on the medication and should be more carefully monitored. Patients can also get fatigue, breast tenderness, they can develop urticaria, and of course, the menstrual irregularities can be quite distressing. Bicalutamide is a non-steroidal anti-androgen. It selectively and competitively inhibits the binding of androgens to the androgen receptor. It's metabolized in the liver and is excreted through the urine and feces. It's FDA approved for the treatment of prostate cancer in doses ranging from 50 to 150 milligrams per day, and it has been used off-label for female pattern hair loss in lower doses, which kind of makes sense. Now, of course, you shouldn't use it in women of childbearing potential because of the risk of feminization of a male fetus, so you have to be thoughtful about that. It has some other pharmacokinetic properties that may favor its use over other first-generation drugs. It has a long half-life, about a week long, so a single oral daily dose would be appropriate. Flutamide has a very short half-life, requiring three doses a day, and it makes you flush, and it can be hepatotoxic. So flutamide is just kind of right out in my personal opinion. There was a pilot study with 17 patients with female pattern hair loss treated with bicalutamide 50 milligrams daily or every other day for at least 24 weeks, and it was given as monotherapy or with other medications, including topical and oral minoxidil, oral finasteride, oral dutasteride, and dutasteride mesotherapy. Mesotherapy being injection of the dutasteride superficially into the dermis. 57% of the patients got significant improvement, so there was some significant response. The same team then evaluated 44 patients a couple years later with a dose ranging from 25 to 50 milligrams per day. Most frequent side effects were reported were increased transaminases with spontaneous resolutions, transient amenorrhea, and endometrial hyperplasia and migraine development. So another group was also looking at the safety of oral bicalutamide in a larger series of patients, 316, treated with doses ranging from 10 milligrams per day to 50 milligrams per day. And that was also used in combination with oral minoxidil and oral spironolactone or used as monotherapy. They did blood work at the beginning of treatment and after 3 months, which was unremarkable. And the study also provided important information about the sort of tolerability of the medication across different doses. Only three patients, however, were using the bicalutamide as monotherapy for at least 6 months, so looking at the overall efficacy of the drug based off of that trial was somewhat challenging. And then the most common doses that were used, they had the 50 every other day, 50 daily. The most common dose that's been studied in the literature was 50 milligrams a day, followed by 25 milligrams a day. They've had studies down to even 10 milligrams daily. Monotherapy has been shown to be efficacious, but it was also shown to be more beneficial when combined with other therapeutics. It doesn't have any diuretic effect, and unlike finasteride, it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. It also has no effect on serum luteinizing hormone, which finasteride increases serum luteinizing hormone, as does flutamide, and spironolactone and cyproterone acetate decrease serum luteinizing hormone. So that's something that we can impact with these other therapeutics, and we do need to think about that. It was also found to be effective on patients that had other types of hyperandrogenism, which was also nice to see. So I think that that was very interesting to perceive that that was a potential therapeutic option for this. Now, the authors, again, reasonably point out that there do need to be larger studies to determine the safe doses and ideal patients for treatment with this medication. But I think that they've put forward a good argument that this is something that should be looked into. So another potential therapeutic for female pattern hair loss. I think that with any kind of hair loss patient, because the hair is sort of an end organ that is very responsive to our internal environment, our nutrition, our exposome, as we've talked about the exposome on this podcast before, the things that our bodies are exposed to, all of those things need to be taken into account when you're treating a patient that has hair loss. And many patients have more than one type of hair loss. Many patients have both female pattern hair loss and also maybe telogen effluvium related to recent illness or poor diet or chronic ongoing stress. And all of those things need to be addressed to help get the patient to a therapeutic endpoint that they're happy with. But it's great to have another tool in the toolkit, and I look forward to further studies on this drug.
I had never heard of bicalutamide, but I have other good news about it. It's cheap.
Woohoo!
About $20. $20 per month if you're doing the 50 milligrams a day, so that's pretty good. I don't know if I'm going to use it, though, Michelle. I actually feel like the state of the art is pretty decent with like pyo-minoxidil, pyo-finasteride, sometimes some spironolactone as well. I feel like I can at least arrest the hair loss for most of my patients with this condition, and I wouldn't need to use this. What do you think? Is it going to have a place in your practice?
You know, I think that for patients that have concern over the use of finasteride, usually when my patients raise a concern over the finasteride, it's because they've Googled it and they've read about post-finasteride syndrome. The vast, vast, vast majority of patients that I treat for hair loss are female patients. And so I do explain to them the connection between erectile dysfunction and depression in patients who have post-finasteride syndrome, which has been reported in men 99% of the time. So it's like 99% of patients who have ever identified as having post-finasteride syndrome are men. So, you know, I think that for our female patients, a lot of them feel more comfortable that way. I do have a few patients who haven't tolerated finasteride for one reason or another that needed an anti-androgen and weren't appropriate for spironolactone or dutasteride necessarily. So this is something else that you can pull out. It's an interesting therapeutic option, at least.
We don't believe that post-finasteride syndrome is real, right?
I have never seen a convincing study that has done the right kind of evaluation to demonstrate that it actually exists. But of course, we always listen to patient perspectives and we take their concerns seriously.
Yeah.
Did you like that very briefly?
People find this stuff online. So when I'm prescribing somebody finasteride, for example, I'll say something like, if you look online, you'll find this. I really don't think it's a real entity. I think people just like to blame their medicines on things, but you'll find it. And
yeah.
I guess they can take my opinion or not if they want. Well, my pediatric patients don't usually lose hair because of female pattern hair loss, but they can certainly lose it from alopecia areata, which is what I would
nice
like to
segue.
Talk to you about.
Yeah, very well done.
Pediatric dermatology. And it's called Pediatric Pulse Dose Corticosteroid Therapy Dosing and Administration in the Treatment of Alopecia Areata, a review of the literature. Primary authors include Natalia Gallega and Lindy Ross out of Tulane and the University of Texas. So pulse dose steroids in alopecia areata. What does that mean? Well, it means giving kids a bunch of steroid, but just for 1 to 3 days and repeating that every month. This is quite different than how I usually use systemic steroids in my practice for alopecia areata. Usually, if I want to use them, I give them to a patient for like 4 to 6 weeks in a taper, something in the 40, 30, 20, 10 milligram approach. So this is different. And this article reviews the available literature on this pulse dose approach. And by the way, this is a CertLink article. So if you maintain your dermatology certification through CertLink, it might look familiar. So the short answer with all this stuff is that pulse dosing with steroid does seem to work okay for alopecia areata with minimal adverse effects and decent regrowth, but about half of patients relapsed. which is fairly consistent, I feel, with alopecia areata in general. Like, I'm somewhat skeptical that we can ever actually move the needle on what the hair is going to do. So sometimes we can give them medicines to help it grow back while we wait for the disease to just kind of go away on its own. But the patients who are going to progress or have recalcitrant disease, I feel like, is going to do that whether or not you treated them. We have had some more success with medicines like methotrexate and some of the JAK inhibitors, but still I worry that a lot of patients start losing their hair again once they finally goes off of those medications. But still, the follow-up for a lot of these patients in this review was in the neighborhood of a year or two, and they said about half of patients relapsed. So if half of them didn't relapse, well, that's not too bad in alopecia areata. They say that many approaches have been used for this pulse dose regimen, both PO and IV. I'll review a few of them that they discussed. So in terms of IV medicine, dexamethasone at 1.5 milligrams per kilogram per day for 1 to 3 days monthly for a maximum of 12 cycles in one study. Also treated with clobetasol. This was about 70 patients. This was a case series. This was all open label stuff. 3 days in a row was better than 1 day. So this is monthly regardless. If you had it 3 days in a row each month, you had 2/3 of your patients with regrowth. If it was just 1 day out of the month, it was 1/3 with regrowth. And then there was IV methylprednisolone tried a number of times in a number of small series, anywhere from 8 to 30 milligrams per kilogram per day for 1 to 3 days out of the month for a maximum of 3 to 10 cycles. Decent regrowth in everybody for an average of about 2/3 of them regrowth. But IV is a pain. We don't want to give people IV steroids for their alopecia areata, I hope. So maybe we can do it via PO. So that has been studied as well. Again, all of this is at best a case series with 70 patients. It's not been any kind of randomized approach. There have been variable doses of prednisolone at various intervals and cycle lengths. Also betamethasone and dexamethasone at a prednisone equivalent of 5 mg per kg. The biggest case series was about 70 patients and used a dexamethasone at 0.8 milligrams per kilogram, which is equivalent to prednisone at 5 milligrams per kilogram. Also used topical clobetasol. This was 1 day out of the month. This was 6 to 12 months long. 56% of patients had good regrowth with this approach. And this is the protocol that the authors ultimately suggest is the most practical with the best data. So once again, 1 day out of each month, you give the patient dexamethasone, 0.8 milligrams per kilogram. They're also using clobetasol every day. And you repeat this every month for 6 to 12 months. The authors say do it for at least 6 months, but you can extend it up to 12 months if necessary. People have also tried PO-methylprednisolone, 50 milligrams per kilogram for 3 days bimonthly for 12 cycles. And again, it all sort of works roughly the same, I would say. They do say that patients with multifocal disease versus those with diffuse or theophiasis pattern get better results. And those who are early in the disease course were also more likely to have sustained improvement. I think that just makes sense with how the disease works, and it's consistent with what we know about alopecia areata. About 2/3 of people just seem to get better on their own. So the earlier you are in their disease course, the more likely they are to just be one of those people who's going to get better. Also, I think we know that the diffuse and ophiasis patterns are the most difficult to bring under control. The ophiasis pattern, by the way, in case you don't quite remember, is when you get it just sort of along the back of the head. And ophiasis was a Greek figure, I believe, a mythological figure who was like a voodoo snake handler kind of guy. So I think the ophiasis is supposed to look like a snake crawling along somebody in the back of their head from ear to ear.
I like the hood.
It is a constellation. A few other little notes here. Methylprednisolone was used in some of these studies because it has been used in studies of adult alopecia areata. The authors who trialed dexamethasone liked that one because it has a longer half-life. Both methylpred and dexamethasone have strong glucocorticoid effects with minimal mineralocorticoid effects, which makes me wonder, why do we use prednisone? Michelle, why do we use prednisone? Why don't we all use dexamethasone?
I think it's habit, and maybe it's cheaper, or whatever drug company had whatever ear of whoever it is that like influences these decisions made that one. It's a good question.
So the conversion is about 0.8 milligrams of dexamethasone for 5 milligrams of prednisolone. So there's various online calculators you can use too if you want to use dexamethasone. I've used it in a few patients. We probably should all be using it as far as I can tell, but maybe there's some good reason to use prednisone. I just don't know what it is. The weaknesses of this study, of course, is that it's reviewing a bunch of case series, which are already of like not great data. There's no placebo arms in anything. So probably a lot of these patients who improved were going to improve whether or not we did anything to them. On the other hand, if we can regrow their hair to some degree while we wait for the disease to get better on its own, that's kind of a win for people who are particularly worried about it. So I might try something like this next time instead of my normal taper over 4 to 6 weeks approach for prednisone. This is a longer term thing. I don't think people are going to start getting better in the first month if you just give them a big old chunk of dexamethasone once. Whereas if you give people prednisone taper for 4 to 6 weeks, they can start getting better over that time frame. But it's also probably faster than something like a methotrexate approach. So it's kind of medium term. I think it probably has a place in my alopecia areata pediatric patients.
It's always nice to have something else to reach for those patients, because especially, you know, when it's abrupt like that, it can really affect their quality of life. I have a couple of kiddos that I always think about when I'm talking about alopecia areata, and one of them was a kid that got hit really hard with alopecia areata right at the beginning of the pandemic, and then that kind of persisted for about a year. And their parents kind of talk about the lost year there where the child just didn't want to do anything. They didn't want to go swimming with their friends in the outdoor pool, which is one of the things kids could do during COVID. There was just a lot of activity limitation and a change in personality because of the hair loss. So I'm always glad that there's another opportunity to pick something out and help improve somebody's quality of life. Speaking of how important skin, hair, and nails are on the quality of life, Luke, and on the opposite end, maybe a little bit of pediatric patients, we're going to talk now about skin, hair, and beyond, the impact of menopause, out of a journal called Climacteric, which is a journal, I believe, that is entirely devoted to the study of what happens to people in menopause. The primary author is Cece Zouboulis, and then the corresponding author is S.R. Goldstein, and there are multiple centers involved, including Dessau Medical Center in Brandenburg, Germany, and we have also a hospital from Berlin, a different hospital from Madrid, Spain, so a couple of different authors participating here, and then also I see Vichy Laboratories in there. I know that Vichy and L'Oreal are all very interested in the skin changes that happen around menopause and are doing some active research in that, so I wonder if that might be a connection there.
Well, there's a potential conflict of interest written at the end that one of these authors is an employee of Vichy Laboratories and the other authors received honoraria as advisory board members for Vichy Laboratories. I wasn't aware of Vichy Laboratories, but I looked it up and it sounds like you're familiar with them, but they sell cosmeceuticals, including those mm-hmm. specifically marketed at postmenopausal women. So certainly a conflict here.
But I do think some of the information they present is quite valid. So they start with their abstract talking about the fact that the skin is an endocrine organ. And I think that any of us that treat teenagers understand that the skin is an endocrine organ. But I feel like we kind of stop thinking about it as an endocrine organ after puberty. So as an endocrine organ, it is a target of hormones, including estrogens, androgens, and cortisol. Aside from the vasomotor symptoms of menopause, which most of us kind of are aware of, the hot flashes and things that can happen and mark that change, skin and hair symptoms occur and often receive a lot less attention than other menopausal symptoms, but they still have a lot of effect on quality of life. So skin and mucosal menopausal symptoms can include dryness, pruritus, thinning, atrophy, wrinkles or sagging, and poor wound healing, which I think is one of the most important things to emphasize, along with reduced vascularity and increased skin changes with exposure. Skin premalignant, malignant lesions and photoaging are typically associated with environmental factors, specifically solar radiation, and those are modifiable. But things like poor wound healing resulting from the loss of hormonal support to the tissue is something that should be looked into. Hair symptoms can include reduced hair growth as well as decreased hair density, sort of a diffuse effluvium because of, I love the way they say this, follicular rarefaction, which is, you know, true. We're kind of losing hair follicles in the process, along with androgenetic alopecia. Altered hair quality, as well as structure, is also something that can happen, along with unwanted hair growth in other areas of the body. Hormone replacement therapy is not indicated for skin and hair symptoms alone because of the risk-benefit balance, but it is part of the discussion to have with women going through that change, including the effect of hormone replacement on the vasomotor symptoms, the bone density, as well as breast, heart, and blood vessels, to allow the patient to make an informed decision. The average age of menopause is 51 years, generally preceded by perimenopause around 2 to 8 years prior to that change. That is when the clinical and biological features of the opposing menopause may commence, and that includes the 12 months following the last menstrual cycle. The age of onset for menopause is multifactorial. It's influenced by genetics, exposome factors, including environmental factors like UV radiation, tobacco smoke, lifestyle factors such as hormones, nutrition, and alcohol consumption, and stress and sleep deprivation. In this review, they focus on skin and mucosal changes as well as hair changes at menopause, and it's a long and meaty article, so we're going to make it into a mini-series and talk about part of it today and part of it on a subsequent episode.
So you're saying we're going to have a pause in our menopause discussion.
Exactly, and I would have been so sad if you hadn't said that, because one of us needed to make that joke, and that was perfect. So perimenopausal symptomatology is variable in different women. Usually within 4 to 5 years of menopause, 80% of women will be devoid of symptoms or only have mild symptoms. So the good news is, for people who are experiencing that change, those symptoms tend to only last 4 to 5 years and then go away. Now, 4 to 5 years is a lot of time to say only before, but it's nice that at least it gets better over time, whereas for 20% of patients, they may have symptoms for 10 years or longer, which is a lot longer to deal with that time. The most common climacteric symptoms, around 75% of women, are vasomotor symptoms, with the hot flashes, night sweats, or sleep disturbance that can occur in perimenopause. The vasomotor symptoms often will cause women to consult a physician, so this might be when they present to discuss the concerns that they have. A lot of patients connect the skin, hair, and mucosa changes that they're experiencing to the menopause, but not all women do, because there's a lack of education around this space, which the authors, I think, aptly point out. A multi-ethnic study in over 3,000 women across the U.S. showed that the median total vasomotor symptom duration was 7.4 years, and risk factors included early or iatrogenic menopause, iatrogenic meaning that the ovaries were removed or in some other way impeded in their function by a surgical or medical procedure. Other things that also increased the risk for hot flashes included skin of color, Hispanic ethnic groups, high body mass index or sedentary lifestyle, smoking, anxiety, depression, psychosocial distress, and the use of selective estrogen receptor modulators, or the SERMs, that are often used to help treat patients who have breast cancer or aromatase inhibitors. Other common symptoms, the genitourinary symptom of menopause, which is the atrophy and loss of moisture and sort of robustness of the genitourinary mucosa, palpitations, headaches, bone, muscle, and joint pain, asthenia, tiredness or insomnia, breast tenderness, dyspareunia, and then, of course, the skin changes. There are also potentially neurological or psychological symptoms, including memory loss, irritability, poor concentration, and loss of confidence. And the insomnia can also contribute to neurological symptoms that can develop. And of course, you also have to worry about things like bone loss, osteoporosis, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and cognitive decline. So being a woman is fun. Anyway.
Yes. Can I take this opportunity to say thank you, women, for perpetuating the species? You guys are tough.
All of the extra stuff you have to go through to deal with that. And then they go over several discussions about some surveys that had been done in menopausal women. The one that I liked the most here was in a survey of over 1,200 women, French women. 72% reported that they noticed changes in their skin at menopause or perimenopause, but only 50% felt that they had been 50% felt that they had been insufficiently informed about these symptoms, which I thought was interesting. And it sounded very French. Nobody told me my skin was going to change. That was the worst French accent ever. I apologize profusely to any French listeners. I did not pull that off. That was terrible, and I apologize. All right. So also, and the authors aptly point out, a woman is frequently judged, I like that they put this, particularly in westernized societies, which is true, by the quality of her skin and hair, which can reflect health and well-being, and this can cause a great psychological burden when these changes occur. So I think that we've made a good argument here that this is something to look into and to understand. Another interesting potential reason to care about this is that there's some evidence that photo damage hits harder without the support of hormones. In this vein, they discuss actually a study that was done very interestingly. They took people and they photo exposed areas, and then afterward they looked for pigmentation. I'm like, how did they get people to sign up for this? But I forget that not everybody lives with the deathly fear of the giant ball of hate in the sky like I do. So some people probably will sign up to be exposed to UV radiation. I'm not sure. But they did photo exposed areas to different patients of different ages, and they found that the menopausal women acquired a higher degree of pigmentation than the premenopausal women after equal exposure time in the sun. So there may actually be a greater hit to the epidermis if you don't have the supportive hormones in the background. Does that kind of make sense? I see your quizzical face.
And an extra arrow in our quiver if we're trying to convince older people that it's not too late to protect themselves from the sun.
And it's a good idea to do it kind of routinely. During perimenopause, they talk about the fact that the peripheral estrogen levels don't steadily decline, but they sort of fluctuate around the normal range. Aromatization of androgens also increases, which leads to variations in sebum levels. And skin dryness may be noticed in early perimenopause, but it can be somewhat compensated by sebaceous gland hypertrophy, which can happen when people become hyperandrogenic. Later in menopause, sebum production is markedly reduced, and the skin can become dry and itchy, followed by potentially sagging and atrophy. Skin atrophy can be due to collagen loss and is more pronounced in menopausal women. In early menopause, the skin collagen levels decrease fairly rapidly, with a collagen reduction of approximately 30% in the first 5 years, which is quite precipitous, followed by a further decline of 2% per year for the next 15 years. And that steady depletion of collagen and reduced skin thickness occurs in menopausal women and has been observed in several studies. Patients also can have diffuse effluvium and worsening of androgenetic alopecia. During menopause, the hair can become thinner and drier, and this may be even more noticeable in people who are genetically predisposed to central parietal hair loss, which are people who have sort of androgenetic alopecia in their family and have the genetics for that. Then, of course, the genitourinary changes that can happen, the vaginal dryness and irritation, reduced elasticity, dyspareunia, potentially urinary urgency, dysuria, and recurrent UTIs can all cause problems after the menopausal transition if not treated. So all of these are important. So I think we've well established that the skin is an endocrine organ and that the sex hormones and other steroids can impact the wellness of that organ system, and that even the androstenedione, sex hormone binding globulin ratio, cortisol, melatonin, insulin-like growth factor, all of this can be related to the pathophysiology of menopause. So we're going to pause our discussion here because we've been kind of discussing the pathophysiology of menopause for a little while. We're going to resume our discussion about how the different hormones that naturally exist in our bodies impact the skin, hair, and nails. And then we'll talk about therapeutics that can be utilized to shore up some of those changes. But I think that that's a good overview, and it well establishes the idea of the skin as an endocrine organ that is impacted significantly by the process of menopause.
All right. Thanks again, ladies. I am now going to discuss an article out of the JAD. What a prestigious article for somebody, a prestigious journal for somebody to be published in. This is an article on which I am an author. So
I was about to say.
It's not often this comes up, but I figure I should talk about some of the work that I do. This is work that I did when I was a fellow, so this is like 5 years ago. And then
I can give you the Pimping Bell salute for this.
Thanks. I mean, a lot of the other authors here are really deserve the credit for bringing it to publication. And they include Jerry Lynn Olson, Pau Castell, David Stevenson, Kevin White, Alfie Kroll, hey Alfie, and Don Siegel. So this is about a disease called Costello syndrome, which is a pretty rare thing, and it's a genoderm. You know, our pediatric dermatologists, we love our genoderms. It's caused by mutations in HRAS. Ding, ding, ding. So remember, this is very testable, though fortunately I don't think there are actually a lot of test questions on this stuff because it's a questionable utility in the real world. But it is a genoderm caused by mutations in HRAS, which is part of the RAS-MAPK pathway, which thus make it a RASopathy, sort of a new designation for a number of these genoderms that are all caused by mutations in genes within this pathway. Among the features of Costello syndrome are perinasal papillomas. So around the nose, these patients get a bunch of little warty growths. And because they look warty, some clinicians try anti-wart treatments on them. Things like candida antigen injections and cidofovir that are specifically antiviral rather than destructive modalities. But is that something we should be doing? Are these actually caused by HPV? Well, for our study, we snipped off some of these nasal papillomas, and we sent them off for analysis. And we discovered that there's no HPV. So these papillomas are probably from the same HRAS mutation that causes the rest of the features of the syndrome. So it's okay to use surgical and destructive modalities to get rid of these things, especially snipping them off or shaving them off. But don't use HPV-specific treatments is the takeaway here, because we don't think there actually is HPV virus in these things. That's what we added to the literature. Other Costello syndrome features, by the way, these patients have growth and developmental delays. They have cardiac anomalies, neurologic issues. Other dermatologic findings include palmal plantar keratoderma, acanthosis nigricans, and generalized hyperpigmentation. If you are hoping for more information about the RAS-MAP kinase pathway, you might be interested that dysregulation of this pathway is also implicated in carcinogenesis. And other RASopathies include CFC syndrome, which is cardiofaciocutaneous syndrome, as well as neurofibromatosis type 1. You know that one pretty well. Legius syndrome, various Noonan syndromes, I guess previous conditions that were referred to as other names are now Noonan syndrome with something or other. So Noonan syndrome with multiple lentigines is now the preferred name for what I learned is Leopard syndrome, for example. There's also a Noonan syndrome-like disorder with loose antigen hair and a Noonan syndrome-like disorder with or without juvenile myelomonocytic leukemia. I hope it's without. Also CMAVM syndrome, which is capillary malformation, arteriovenous malformation syndrome, and a condition called SYNGAP1 hyphen intellectual disability. Those are all examples of RASopathies. So exciting for me to have something published anywhere, especially in the JAD. So thanks very much to my co-authors and mentors for helping to make this happen and contributing. So if you do have a patient with Costello syndrome, please don't target HPV. It ain't there.
But the HPV vaccine is great for anybody. So I think that, you know, if you have a patient that is on the fence about that, there's a lot of other great reasons to use that vaccine.
As cool as Costello syndrome is, Michelle, you know what's even cooler?
I'm ready to see it.
Dr. Steve Feldman! He's back! Woo! Hooray! Welcome back, Steve. Do you want to introduce yourself? Some of our listeners might have the misfortune of not having heard any of your previous episodes.
Yeah, I'm Steve Feldman. I'm a professor here at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Just, all as always, it's just such a joy to be with you guys.
It's a joy to have you. Dr. Feldman has multiple areas of expertise. One of them is behavioral economics, especially as it applies to healthcare, and I suppose is specifically in dermatology. He even wrote a book about it with some co-authors. It's called An Illustrated Dictionary of Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. Go buy it on Amazon, because we're using it as our roadmap to continue kind of walking through some of the concepts of behavioral economics. So now we're going to talk about Chapter 5, Framing. Steve, you want to tell us about framing?
Yeah. How we frame things, how we present things has a big impact on how those things are received. And in this chapter, which was written by my son, Noah, he covered things that are free, the IKEA effect, and the certainty effect. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever put together anything from IKEA. You know, you put together this piece of junk furniture and then you just love it. Oh my God. Cause you're just so emotionally tied to your effort and, and such. I think my son made the point of some pottery he made when he was in elementary school that nobody on earth would ever buy, but he was like, he and certainly his parents were so emotionally attached to those things.
Could also be called the Lego effect, perhaps. I still have I was looking in my parents' closet the other day because I was looking for one of my kids' lost stuffed animals. And I found this Lego castle that I probably had made when I was 17 years old. But there it is, still together. And I did not take it apart and put it in the bin with all the other Legos. It's still there. So I think framing is a pretty big concept. Like a lot of these concepts, it probably can include a number of other smaller concepts. So the way that Noah describes it in the book is framing is the tendency for a person to change how they value a set of options based on the current frame of reference or the frame from which the option is presented. And he does talk about these three specific effects in this chapter. And I suspect as we continue to kind of move through the book, we'll find other examples of, hey, that could be considered an example of framing as well. So I mentioned this IKEA effect. One, by the way, I like IKEA furniture. I don't want the IKEA company to think that we consider their furniture pieces of junk. I have fond memories also of building furniture together with some of my friends and family members, and it was a bonding experience. We didn't, not only did we bind the pieces of the furniture together, but we felt more closely to each other. Mm-hmm. But an interesting piece of psychology that comes along with it is that when you make something, subconsciously or consciously, you ask yourself, am I good at making stuff? And then you might think something like, well, I made a decision to make this thing, and I wouldn't make that decision unless I was at least decent at making stuff. So if I thought I was not good at making stuff, what the hell am I doing here? So yeah, I must be pretty good at making stuff, which means this thing I made must be pretty good. And human beings have such complex psychology. I think that's also an interesting piece to look at. How can we use this to our diabolical advantage? To use their medicines, for example.
Yeah. So I think we're emotional beings, and our emotions are very powerful motivators. And perhaps for this IKEA effect, if people felt they were involved in deciding on a treatment plan, they would be more emotionally invested in seeing that it work and sticking with it. So perhaps what we could do is give people, for example, eczema. You give them a choice of three or four different bathing techniques, three or four different topicals, three or four different moisturizer options. And you could pick one in each of those categories that you really want them to do. And you could make the other options really crazy things, right? That nobody would ever choose. But then when you go through the procedure of choosing with the patient, they would end up choosing the four things that you would want them to do anyway, that you could have just told them at the beginning, let's do this, 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 and this. But now they feel like they chose it. They created this treatment plan for themselves, almost like it's like an IKEA treatment plan. I bet that would, I've never tested that. Be pretty easy to do. I bet that would drive people to be more invested.
I think you're right about that, actually. Like using a menu of different things and they can pick.
I feel like a lot of us probably do that without possibly consciously realizing that we're doing it. One of my common statements to patients is, I think we have several reasonable paths forward right now. We could do this, we could do this, or we could do this. And then, you know, they kind of pick one of them. And that's very similar to this approach.
Yeah. And I think we can make it even more impressive. One of the options would be, how often do you want to put your topical steroid on? Once a day, mm-hmm. four times a day, or eight times a day? Now, you're going to tell them once a day, right? But if mm-hmm. you let them choose that, and they feel like, oh, wow, I created this plan with my doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. And there's also this free effect, and free has an exclamation point. It's the free effect, which is the idea that things that are free, at least in the sense that they don't cost money, have kind of an extra appeal to us. And there's a nice example that Noah discusses in here where at the end of a checkout line at like a hospital cafeteria, they had a little box of Hershey's Kisses and a box of fancy chocolates, and you could only take one or the other. And in one set, the Kisses were 1 cent and the fancy chocolates were 15 cents. And in the other, the Kisses were free and the fancy chocolates were 14 cents. So either way, you're spending 14 cents more for the fancy chocolates, which are just better overall. But people picked up way more Kisses when they were free. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this, perhaps, is that people are just excited to be able to say, I want that, and then they get it without having to exchange money. And perhaps mm-hmm. that kind of obscures some of the other costs of picking whatever is, quote, free. For example, both chocolates give you a bunch of calories. Perhaps you might as well pick the tastier one. And you can only pick one or the other. So if you pick Hershey's Kiss for free, you wouldn't get this fancy chocolate. So that's an interesting way that our brains work, especially when it comes to money as well.
Yeah, I wonder if we couldn't come up with something very similar in our world. If you told a patient the copay for the visit is $45 or $50, I don't think it would change their behavior one lick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you have a skin cancer screening that's free versus one that costs $5, my guess is a lot of people aren't going to show up for the $5 one. Unless they paid in advance. That's for another show, perhaps. But if you just told me free skin cancer clinic or $5 skin cancer clinic, people are going to come for the free one more than maybe the $5 one.
Well, and I feel like the pharmaceutical companies are aware of this because they have all those coupons.
Yeah, so if you can get a medicine for free, that might be an extra incentive. I think it could help us with our normal lives as well, especially if we realize this potential tendency of ours and we actually do the opposite. So for example, when there's a free admission day at the zoo, you know, your first thought is, oh, cool, I want to go to the zoo for free. The zoo's fun. But then you show up and like half the city is there because they also felt the same way. And you think to yourself, geez, I'd rather have just spent the $50 admission to get in here. So I'm trying not to accept stuff that is free, but instead pay for it. Same is true with apps, by the way. People don't seem to like paying for apps. They're kind of used to getting them for free. But it has been said that if you are not paying for it, then you are the product. So I heard somebody or other pointed, I want to be their customer, because otherwise they're just like getting my information and probably selling it to somebody else. So it's worth spending $2 for some dumb app rather than getting it for free to avoid the ads, or so your kids don't see the ads, or just so that you can have paid for it and be their customer. Because who cares about $2?
I have kind of a way that I sort of use this. It's not exactly the free thing, but it sort of puts together the IKEA effect with the less cost part, where when I'm trying to treat patients that have bad diaper dermatitis, and this was easier when this product existed, but there was a medication called Fusion, and it was like zinc oxide and something for yeast and a topical steroid and lilac fragrance, which the dermatologists hated and the product manufacturers insisted on because the moms liked it. The moms liked the lilac fragrance. But it was a nice diaper dermatitis cream, but I think it was like $400 a tube or something insane like that. And so it could use the IKEA effect. I'd be like, okay, well, they have this $400 cream that would help solve a lot of these problems. Or you could use these three things which cost pennies, put them together in your palm, mix it together and put it on the baby. And there you have, you know, kind of outsmarted this drug company and helped your baby get better. And the buy-in was a lot better with that approach than just kind of saying, well, you know, this is really expensive. So instead of that, you can do this. Like the outwitting of other people effect seemed to help people be interested in doing it. Like they're like, oh, I'm smarter than this drug company. I can do this, you know.
Yeah, well said. I suspect that the people who are into frankincense and myrrh and these various oils and put together their concoctions of stuff, their adherence to treatment probably be better than anything I get any patient to do.
Yes. Or the notorious black salve. Do you have that where you practice?
Yeah.
I don't know what it has in it.
It dissolves away the skin.
Yeah, it's something that has, I think there's tar in it or something, because it's black in color. And there's a lot of, I think, different regional variances of it, but people kind of use it for everything. So,
you know, like that free effect, certainty is kind of like something being free. And I think it has a big effect on my thinking. So, you know, I've got some drugs for psoriasis that I perceive as being essentially free of side effects. Interleukin-23 drugs, essentially free of side effects. And then I have these IL-17 drugs that are not quite free, but they're pretty close. But they're not, there's a level of uncertainty, small, because of inflammatory bowel disease, real small. But on the other hand, the IL-17 drug might work a lot faster, get my patient's disease under control quicker, and they would like to get under control quicker. But I have this strong tendency to say, let's use the IL-23 drug, because I like that freedom from the certainty. Small risks have disproportionately large effects on our thinking.
The certainty effect is also specifically called out again in this chapter, with the idea that people prefer things that are certain rather than those that might have a small risk of some problem, even though hypothetically, from a strictly mathematical standpoint, they would be better. So if you said to somebody, you have a choice, I'll give you $100 or I'll give you $200, but you have to flip a, you know, you have to roll a die. And if it turns out to be a six, then you don't get nothing. Then they're much more likely to pick the $100 instead of roll the die. I don't actually know if it's mathematically better. Haven't done it, but that's the idea. Yeah. And in this chapter, they save what I would consider the most frequent use of this that I use until the very end, which is just flipping your percentage numbers around. So rather than saying that something has a 1% chance of your head exploding, you can say, good news, there's a 99% chance that your head will not explode with this medicine. That's almost everybody. So I often say things like, there's a real small risk of side effects that we can't monitor for with methotrexate, for example. But, you know, 99.99% of people don't have that problem, rather than saying there's a real small chance that this could be you.
Yes, the way I frame it with treatments for severe psoriasis would be to tell people, oh, my God, right now, your immune system is totally out of balance. And right now, you have like, you know, a 1 in 100 chance of developing a serious infection. But we can put you on this all natural organic anti-inflammatory that will complement your natural healing mechanisms. It'll bring your immune system back into balance and harmony, because I like to take a holistic approach. Once your immune system's working well again, then 99 times out of 100, there's no serious infection.
I love it.
Very well done. I like the ability to sort of give people a frame of reference to operate from, because you're absolutely right that these emotional decisions, they kind of like catch a person and then they can't get out of it without help usually. And I've experienced that personally before.
Yeah. We talked about salience in the last episode or so, and these are very salient things, a serious infection. You imagine if you say one in anything, you imagine what it's like to be that one. This is going to have a disproportionate effect on your thinking.
Yeah, if you say to somebody 1 in 5 versus 1 in 20, their brain's probably not going to separate those.
You could say 1 in 5 or 1 in 5 million. The human brain is not designed to handle numbers like 5 million. We don't talk about this in North Carolina much, but if you believe in evolution, human brains just didn't have much use for numbers like 1 million or even 1,000, even 100. Yeah. Until recently.
More than we could count didn't have a lot to do with our survival for a very long time.
Well, thanks for joining us for this one, Steve. People can find you at Wake Forest. They can find your work on PubMed. They can find your book on Amazon. Any other thoughts you want to leave our listeners with today?
No, I feel somewhat guilty and that your listeners aren't getting to be on this podcast as much as I am. It's just such a joy to be here with y'all.
We're always so glad to have you.
Well, we'll bring you right back on next time. And listeners, that is all we have time for. So thank you for joining us today. So today we learned about resistant tinea, trichophyton endotineae, suspected if your patient doesn't get better with pyoterbinafine. We learned about bicalutamide. Perhaps you should consider using it for female pattern hair loss. And speaking of hair loss, we learned that pulse dose steroids might be helpful and a good option for alopecia areata, especially in pediatric patients. We learned a little about menopause. Boy, there's a lot going on there. We learned about Costello syndrome and how the perinasal papillomas are unrelated to HPV. And we learned about framing with Steve Feldman. So thanks again to Dr. Feldman for joining us. And thanks to all of our listeners for hanging out with us today. Thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us the shell. Thanks also to all of our members of Team Dermosphere. They keep various things moving along here. We really appreciate everything that you guys do. Our team now includes Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Aparna Nayak, Haley Walsh, Neha Deo, Angie Wong, and Laura Dela Cruz. Thanks very much, guys. One thing you guys do is keep our social media accounts moving along. You can find us at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which is a good way to get in touch with us, as well as a good way to look at all of the articles that we discussed through our entire archive. If you want to hang out with us in other ways as well. Once again, you can find us in the University of Utah Dermatology Echo every month. See the show notes for that one. You can see me in person at a couple meetings in Idaho in September. Again, check the show notes. And if you want to check us out on ViewMedi now, you can do that too. All sorts of ways to keep chilling with us while you wait for the 2 weeks until we're back at you. We'll see you then.